Now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is participants on the world stage. Each of my guests is discussing the impact that they've had on the world stage. My next guest is the youngest guru included in the Guide to the Greatest Management Thinkers of All Time, published by The Economist back in 2008. He has empirical data that globalization is not bad, and he'll explain the world has farther to go when it comes to globalization from his latest book, World 3.0. If you want to join in the conversation or if you have an opinion, you can always call us at 639-0008. Pankaj Gamelet is a professor at the Global Strategy at Inessa Business School in Europe. Between 1983 and 2008, he was on the faculty of the Harvard Business School, where in 1991 he became the youngest person in the school's history to be appointed a full professor. Pankaj is also the youngest guru included in the Guide to the Greatest Management Thinkers of All Time, as I said earlier. Pankaj's latest book is titled World 3.0. Pascal Lamé, who is the director of the World Trade Organization, describes it as offering recommendations that should inspire all global stakeholders in time of major global challenges. Welcome to the show, Pankaj. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks, and a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being my special guest. I loved your book because it flies in the face of some commonly held beliefs. Thomas Friedman wrote in his book, The World is Flat. He points out that global trade and foreign direct investment is making international borders meaningless. Some believe that the world globalization is at about 50%. We're globalized to about 50%. You suggest, however, that globalization is not that high. It's somewhere between 10 and 15%. So how do such exaggerations about the level of cross-border globalization reflect biased beliefs about globalization?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons why people's sense of globalization is overblown. One is, since you mentioned Tom Friedman, when I first published these data in Foreign Policy, Tom wrote in to suggest that my data were narrow. And at that point, I couldn't resist pointing out that Tom had written a 450-page book without a single table, figure, chart, reference, or footnote. Given that Tom sold more books on globalization than all his predecessors combined, I think it's fair to say that most of the debate has been essentially free of data of any sort.
Why let the facts get in the way, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well,
I think it goes beyond that. I think there's a sense in which if you espouse this rhetoric about borders not mattering, about the world being one, about the nation state being obsolete, you're modern and with it. And if you don't, you're hopelessly behind the times. And so it's almost a badge of modernity to profess belief in these exaggerations.
But how can that be in any way dangerous, though? I mean, isn't the world sort of moving in this direction anyway? You're just on the forefront of that thinking?
Well, I think that, first of all, there's the empirical issue of how soon we'll get there. And second, there's the issue of what are the dangers of getting there ahead of time, as it were. So I think that if you take current levels of cross-border integration and extrapolate them, not in my lifetime, and I'm not that old yet, do I expect us to reach this end state that Friedman and many others before him have talked about? In terms of what the dangers are, I see two principal dangers. First of all, if you believe that the world is already close to 100% integrated, you don't see much headroom for or many potential gains from further integration. So you miss out on one of the key potential motors of growth in the world economy. And second, emphasizing that globalization is close to 100%, simply exacerbates people's fears about globalization and actually has the risk of provoking a backlash, whereas 10 to 20% globalization is much less likely to trigger that kind of reaction, much less likely to have people blame anything that they don't like on cross-border integration, which is a much more normal response if you believe that the world is fully integrated.
All right. We're talking to Pankaj Gemelet, and we're talking about his book, World 3.0. And speaking of backlash, let's talk about it in terms of the United States. Unionists and protectionists and other anti-globalists believe that globalization is bad, and that started way back in 1992, and then presidential candidate Ross Perot called the North America Free Trade Agreement a giant sucking sound, a very graphic image that he used there. Others believe that we're losing manufacturing jobs to China because China has the cheapest labor. I would remind those people that the United States still leads in airplane manufacturing, heavy equipment manufacturing, elevator and escalator manufacturing, film, TV, and the Internet. But that's what you call in your book World 1.0 thinking. In what ways are our fears about globalization just blown completely out of proportion?
Well, I think, first of all, on job losses, there are data suggesting that technological change is responsible for 10 to 40 times as many in the way of job losses as is import competition in the U.S. economy. But again, if you believe that everything has to do with globalization, any job loss is in fact chalked up to globalization. I think that what we're seeing right now is, unfortunately, the inevitable consequence of high unemployment rates, which is also applies to some of the resistance in the early 1990s. Right now, the U.S. economy has 7 million fewer jobs than it did when the recession started in December 2007. Looking at the maximum rate of job creation that the U.S. economy has ever managed to sustain over a period longer than a month, about 200,000 new jobs, we're talking about close to 3 years before this backlog is worked off. And, of course, we're already more than a year into what was supposed to be a recovery. So I think the big danger is that people experiencing unemployment, and U.S. rates are actually quite moderate compared to, say, the 21% unemployment rate in Spain, which is where I currently live, have a huge temptation to shut down on borders and grab domestic demand for domestic supply. And unfortunately, of course, if everybody does that, which is what happened back in the 1930s, we risk a catastrophe.
We do, Pankaj, but isn't that where we're going? I mean, since the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009, here in the United States, many politicians and citizens believe that we need to focus on the United States first and hang Europe, hang Japan, hang the rest of the world. Aren't we getting a lot of this protectionist rhetoric being floated around not only here in the United States, but probably in Europe and Japan as well?
Well, I'm reminded of what Ben Franklin said about either we hang together or we shall all hang separately. And that strikes me as exactly the situation that we face right now, because we know that a move back towards localization and protectionism is not going to do the world economy or any particular state within it a great deal of good. And let me give you an illustration. There's a huge emphasis, not just in the U.S., on this idea that we insulate ourselves from problems from far away if we just localize everything. Well, somebody in Philadelphia tried to make a suit, just to take one example, out of inputs available within a 100-mile radius of Philadelphia. And suits are not exactly high-tech, and this wasn't going to be a very fancy suit anyway. Turned out it costs more than 100 times as much.
Wow.
So, do that, and what emerged wasn't quite a suit. You know, the sleeves weren't there, and, you know, 8% of the inputs had to be imported anyway, and so forth. And remember, this is suit manufacture, which isn't subject to huge economies of scale. Imagine what it would be like if computers or airliners were subject to localizing impulses. But we are seeing an awful lot of daffiness. When I hear about, for instance, to pick another example, countries in the Middle East deciding to grow their own food for food security, I'm thinking about the United Arab Emirates, I'm thinking, what are people expecting would happen if we resorted to the least cost-efficient ways of doing things? That's not what the world economy needs right now.
Without a doubt. But in the friction that you're talking about, Pankaj, is the friction of governments. So what would a shift towards this world 3.0 that you write about in your book mean for governments? You know, what would it lead to? It sounds to me if we don't pull back and we don't retrench, what are governments going to need to do in order to grease the skids, if you will, of world 3.0?
Well, I mean, I think that clearly, you know, governments need to, first of all, resist the protectionistic sentiments that large swathes of their electorates in particularly Western countries are subjecting them to. And so avoiding a rollback of the gains that we've already experienced is, especially in the short run to medium run, while unemployment rates are still high, is perhaps the most that can be hoped for. And I must say that so far, I have been pleasantly surprised post-crisis by the fact that there hasn't been more overt protectionism than what we've actually experienced. Second, there are still huge gains to be had. This is the point of 10 to 20% levels of globalization currently. There's still huge gains to be had by pushing further with integration. And the agenda there is relatively clear. Of course, people focus on the Doha round of trade talks. And of course, it's important to try and get some kind of deal because, as the U.S. envoy to the World Trade Organization pointed out, if we don't do this, the next time that we're likely to be in a position to be discussing concluding a trade round is going to be sometime in the 2020s, just given how long these things take and so forth. But beyond that, beyond just sort of liberalizing merchandise trade, which has been the traditional focus of trade talks,
right,
there's agricultural trade, there's trade and services where frameworks need to be put in place. There's, and this is less of an issue for the U.S. than it is for Europe and Japan, but there are other kinds of openness that promise even larger gains. Both Europe and Japan have rapidly aging populations. Unless they open up to more immigrants, the dependency ratios that they're going to be facing 20, 30 years from now are going to impose a crushing burden on these countries. And of course, a time of high unemployment is not exactly the time to push hardest for more immigration. But if one looks beyond the current 1 to 5 years and thinks about what Europe, for instance, needs to do going forward, clearly if there's going to be a solution, immigration is going to be, expanded immigration is going to be a large part of that solution.
Well, I think that that is true. We're talking to Pankaj Gemelet about his book, World 3.0. But don't you think, Pankaj, that this is really going to be inevitable anyway? You've got Italy, you've got Japan with these aging populations. If they don't open up the doors, they will implode. There is no doubt about it. And sooner or later, whether it's now or 20 years from now, they're going to come to the realization that immigration is important to them and have to open up the borders, don't you think?
Sooner would be a lot better than later.
Yes, it would. But one of the things that...
It would be much better for the Italians and the Japanese to figure this out before the dependency ratio reaches such a critical level that it's going to condemn them to 10, 20 years of stagnation before they can get back on track.
Fair enough. Now, one of the things that you talk about is more this liberalization between countries is going to lead to a need for overarching regulations between countries and so forth. And here's where maybe you and I disagree a little bit, because in 2010, there were 6 linear feet of new regulation in the United States that were introduced. I mean, if you took all of the documents and laid them end to end, it was 6 linear feet. I can't imagine, if we go worldwide, what the new regulation is going to look like and how onerous that's going to be for small and medium-sized businesses.
Yeah. No. I think there, perhaps I didn't explain my arguments as well as I should have. I do start with the premise that, assuming that markets sometimes fail, is unfortunate but realistic assumption to make about the world that we live in. So I don't see all forms of governmental intervention as market distortions in the pejorative sense that Alan Greenspan still describes them. I see some regulation necessary. But to me, the principal appeal of integration is the idea that at a time when people both have a distrust of unbridled markets, but also skepticism about the ability of governments to correct those excesses. Integration, at least in some cases, suggests a way of achieving gains while alleviating rather than exacerbating market failures. And if we have time, I'd like to give you one very specific example.
It'll have to be quick. We are running out of time, but give it to me.
So surveys suggest biggest fear people have about markets are large companies displacing small ones, concentration. Integration is a proven way of reducing concentration levels without necessarily calling for the heavy hand of the regulator to achieve that effect. Think of what the entry of foreign car producers did to the big three U.S. producers, which historically had competed just on tail fins, if you think back to the oligopoly in the 1950s and 1960s. So what's attractive to me about integration is the idea that while it doesn't relax the state versus markets trade-off, while it doesn't remove it, it does relax that trade-off. It allows us to make further headway without putting all the chips on the state to regulate markets better or putting all our faith in markets to just work better on their own.
Well, now that makes a solid argument. We've been talking to Pankaj Gemmelet about his latest book, 3.0, Global Prosperity and How to Achieve It. Pankaj, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
www.gemmelet.com.
And you're going to have to spell that for my listeners.
And, yes, for most people, actually, Gemmelet is G-H-E-M-A-W-A-T, www.gemmelet.com.
Pankaj, thank you so much for being my special guest. We'll have to have you back because there's so much more to your book, World 3.0, that I want to get into. But we'll talk to you later. Talk to you down the road.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you.
To be with you.
Thank you.